News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We have a big hour coming your way. Bill McGurn from the Wall Street Journal sat down with the president yesterday. He met with the editorial board. They got a column today about really how he's going to leave the WTO, it seems. And Stephanie Zenker will be with us, the strategic director of the Libra Institute in Georgia. I want to get a sense of what's happening on the ground. I'm tired of looking at the polls. I want to talk to people that actually have been reporting on it and understand these battleground states. Also, it is an exciting week for us. We had three stations in one day, WLNA, 1420 AM in Peekskill, New York. I'll be there in Peekskill on Sunday at 7. You'll see it stream on Fox Nation. WBNR, 1260 AM in Beacon, New York. And WGHQ, 920 AM in Kingston, New York. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
This entire room is filled with some of the most powerful people in New York City, and Brian Kilmeade. Remember, Brian, I told you? Brian and I started doing stand-up together, so we're friends. Hopefully.
That was great. Jim Gaffigan called me out yesterday on the dais at the 79th Al Smith dinner. Six blocks from our studios last night at the powerful people, most powerful people in America gathered for this charity event, and didn't feature both presidential candidates for the first time in four decades because the vice president didn't show but submitted a tape, and it was awful.
Number two.
Those in the administration, they're calling for Sinwar's death is the opening to the end of the war. That's preposterous, given the facts that are on the ground. There's thousands of Hamas fighters still in Gaza. And Israel can't just walk away from that.
Yes, General Jack Keane, 100% right. But the first story in the Jerusalem Post, President Biden, it's time for Gaza war to end. Blinken to visit Israel. Yes, Hamas's leader and October 7th architect, Yahya Sinwar, spends his first full day in hell, thanks to the IDF. Why, as usual, President Biden and Harris are once again pressuring for a ceasefire. Let's make this clear. It should be surrender in the war and surrender all hostages.
Number one.
They'll say, let's go out with this one. They've tried many different things. They tried, he's a dictator. He's going to take over the whole world. He's a this. Every week they try something else. So far it hasn't worked. I guess that's the attack they have for this week. It doesn't seem to be working.
2024, 18 days and counting. That was President Trump 20 minutes ago at Fox and Friends. Trump has momentum, but no one has won this thing yet. His latest comments from his visit to our studios this morning and on the state of the race. And let's get started. Essentially, I do think he's got the momentum. I thought last night he was pretty strong. I thought that Kamala Harris not showing up to this iconic event. And I bring this up not because I'm located in New York, but because you go to the Hilton in New York with the former president, the same place that, that Clinton won and Bush won and Romney won and McCain. And I mean, it goes back for decades, 79 years. This guy was governor, ran for president, the first Catholic to run for president. And it's a huge fundraiser for St. Patrick's Cathedral and all the Catholic causes or any charitable causes. But foolishly, and I heard last night it was on Hillary Clinton's recommendation. She, instead of showing up and having somebody write comedy, think about all the comedians that are supporting her. All celebrities are supporting her. All these talented writers are supporting her. They would have put together the most killer monologue ever. They would have probably put it on teleprompter for her, and she still doesn't show up. Instead, we get this, cut six.
We are, and I am campaigning to earn every single vote because I intend to be a president for all Americans. No matter their political party, where they live, or where they get their news.
Now, keep in mind, President Trump also has to be in the battleground states. They also have private planes. She could have easily been back. And as Jim Gaffigan said, this is the biggest layup in history. And she did not show up and she did not, I don't know, make the most of that opportunity. I do want to talk about Sinwar and I want to get to this. But it is really meaning with 18 days left, every little thing counts. And I think this counts. Here's a little of what went on last night with Donald Trump. Cut 29.
Chuck Schumer is here looking very glum. Doesn't he look glum? He looks glum. But look on the bright side, Chuck, considering how woke your party has become. If Kamala loses, you still have a chance to become the first woman president. I don't think Kamala has given up yet. She hasn't. Instead of attending tonight, she's in Michigan receiving communion from Gretchen Whitmer. Unfortunately, Governor Walz isn't here himself, but don't worry, he'll say that he was. He's going to say he was. Mayor Adams, good luck with everything. They went after you. They went after you, Mayor. Yeah, boy, I knew that. 9.5 months ago, I said, you know, he just said something about it, about the administration. He's going to be indicted any moment.
And he wasn't wrong, and everyone kind of laughed. The only guy that really got a terrible reception was Bill de Blasio. In case you don't know, around the country, worst mayor ever, lazy, didn't do anything. He took a city that was running like a top from Rudy Giuliani and one of these great businessmen. You might agree with him on everything, but he did a really good job for 3 terms in New York. A billionaire. It took a dollar to do the job. And then this guy just threw it in the street. Adams is mediocre at best, if not even, and they find up all this other stuff that he's doing. It seems right now, it seems like he's overcharged, but there was kind of a mixed reaction there. So before we go, and we'll talk more about this, and I'll play Jim Gaffigan, who was a riot. Newt Gingrich looked at this whole thing, watched it home. He's been through it all, seen, he's been on the dais himself. Cut 42.
Kamala Harris is clearly the most anti-Catholic candidate, I think, since James Blaine in 1880. And you start from that. And Walz is worse. Remember, Walz, at one point during COVID, issued a ruling that you could have up to 50 people in a bar and 10 people in a church. At another point, he closed all the churches but allowed Mall of the America to stay open so people could have what he called retail therapy. I mean, I think it's important to understand the left wing of the Democratic Party, which is now most of it, is deeply anti-religious. And especially anti-Catholic, because so many Catholic views, and whether it's on life or it's on transgenderism or you name it, are views that are abhorrent to the Kamala Harris wing of the Democratic Party.
I totally agree with Newt Gingrich. He's 100% right. There's only 3 reasons why she'd miss. Number one, no confidence can deliver any comedy. Number two, anti-Catholic. She knows she'd clash with people on her stance on abortion, especially she goes up to abortion clinics. She likes like abortions like a day at Disney. It's the best thing ever. And number three, she didn't want to normalize Trump. You believe this? 70 million people voted for him in 2020. He's more popular now than ever before, but she doesn't want to normalize him. All three are plausible. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Stephanie Zanker will tell us what's happening in Georgia. Bill McGurn about his meeting with the former president last night and their economic plans going forward. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I just saw a Hispanic poll where I'm at 52%. Nobody's ever seen that before. Republicans never been there before. I'm at 52%. And with black men, I'm at 32% and 31%. Story. This is sort of throwing their formulas off a little bit. You know, it's, this is a little bit of a change.
Now, last time he was real, he got higher, got real high for the black community, but it was under 20%. For a Republican, it was high. Now, this time, he feels like he's at 32%, which is still low in the big picture, but it's extraordinarily high when it comes to traditional voting blocks. Joining us now to talk about what that means possibly for the vote in Georgia is Stephanie Zanker, the strategic director of the Libre Initiative over in Georgia, nonpartisan, nonprofit that uses limited government, free market principles to empower the Latino community. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you, Brian. Happy to be here.
Hey, give me an idea of what's happening in Georgia. The one thing that everyone sees is huge early voter turnout. Number one, do you concur with that? Number two, what do you think that means?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the overall early vote turnout is up significantly. I mean, we're seeing historic participation. Day one voting had over 300,000 people vote in person. Day two had over 270,000. So far, we're almost at 1 million people who've cast their votes early, which is just absolutely historic. And we're seeing Republicans actually outpacing Democrats in early voting, which is it's the opposite of what happened in 2020 and 2022. And it's the opposite of what typically happens. So we'll see if that holds up as early in-person voting continues through November 1st.
You know, even Marjorie Taylor Greene voted early. So the president has totally backed out of that. And his whole team says vote early. These are the rules. You don't like them. We want election day, but this is the way it is. But Georgia was one of the first to reform after 2020. How's it going?
I mean, it's going really well. And I think there's enthusiasm for the system, you know, and I think that's apparent by how many people are going out there. That's showing confidence in the voting system. So, yeah, I think it's too early to see, but there's definitely enthusiasm on both sides right now.
What about the hand counting? How does that relate? Did they get rejected by the courts when it comes to hand counting ballots?
You know, I'm actually not too sure about that, Brian.
Okay. Give me an idea of the Latino community and how they seem to be responding to both the Harris message and the Trump message.
So, yeah, I mean, we're definitely seeing the Latino community moving to the right generally. I mean, there's just a lot of disillusionment, broken promises by the Biden-Harris administration over the last few years. And, you know, we're just seeing the outcome of bad policies. And, you know, there's just been over the last four election cycles a slow and steady bleed away from the Democrat Party. Democrats, you know, at one point had an almost 40% lead with the Latino community. Now we're seeing that's much smaller. It's like around 18 to 19%. And Latino values are more closely aligned with traditional conservative values. You know, they prioritize faith, family, community, freedom, hard work. And they're just seeing that the American dream is just becoming much, much harder to achieve. Our sister organization, the Libre Institute, just did a poll that found that 71% of Latinos still believe in the American dream, but 88% think it's harder and harder to achieve. It's going to be harder for their kids and those younger generations to achieve. And 76% believe that we're losing our traditional values, which is something that's really important to the Latino community. We're definitely seeing a significant shift to the right among Latinos.
Yeah, I think that's what we hear. And they always said that I remember talking to the Bush camp saying, you know, I'm standing for traditional values. We stand for family first. I wonder why the Hispanic vote, the Republicans wouldn't be doing better with the Hispanic vote. And eventually there was a theory out there that the more you let Hispanics in, illegally or legal, the better it is for Democrats. We might be looking to get rid of that theory. But Stephanie, as you look at what's happening in Georgia now, the word is Brian Kemp is all in to help out Trump. They went from rivalry to working together. Have you seen the Kemp ground game?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. They had somewhat of a tenuous relationship for a little bit there. But I think, you know, Brian Kemp has been doing a great job in Georgia, and he, you know, enjoys a lot of enthusiasm from people, Latinos and, you know, non-Latinos here. And I think he just understands the importance of working with Trump because the stakes of this election are just so high and so important.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess we're seeing that. So early voting started. You have Governor Kemp helping. What are the polls you're looking at to give us an idea of where it's tilting?
I mean, we're just looking at, so Libre Institute did a poll, and you know, we've just been using GeorgiaVotes.com, which is a really great resource. And we have our own internal system that we use to look at data. And so far, about 18,000 Hispanics have voted so far. That represents about 2% of the vote. But they make up 10% of Georgia's population. And, you know, if you remember in 2020, Biden won this, you know, extremely important swing state by fewer than 12,000 votes. So, I mean, you've already have more Hispanic votes. So the Latino community has the ability to impact the direction that Georgia ultimately goes.
So describe to us the difference, because we watched Kelly Loeffler lose. We watched Perdue lose. We watched Herschel Walker lose. And Democrats just find a way to edge it out. So do you think this will be different?
I think this will absolutely be different. I mean, the Latino community, not only the Latino community, but especially the Latino community is just is just fed up with, you know, all the policies of the last 4 years. The cost of living is super high. Inflation has gotten out of control. And they're going to be looking toward candidates, and they're excited to vote for candidates that are freedom-minded, that are going to, you know, bring job security back and lower the cost of living, because inflation disproportionately affects the Latino community. The families are larger. They have more mouths to feed. I mean, on average, they're spending about $12,000 more on just to achieve the cost of life that they had, you know, pre-Biden-Harris administration. So there's definitely significant difference and enthusiasm.
So the president was just on Fox and Friends, and the Hispanic and black folk came up. Cut three.
You guys are the same as me. It's the same stuff. We were born the same way. I grew up in Queens and all of that. I mean, you know, it's I had a great father. I had a father who was a great guy. He was tough but good, big heart, big heart. And he was a construction guy, pretty much, and a real estate guy. And I learned a lot from him. He was great. But I know you people so well. Without knowing you, I know you so well. When I walked in here, I said, this is home territory.
So he was talking, he was in a barbershop, and they did a whole shoot in a barbershop. And in that section of the Bronx where he did it, it's half Hispanic, mostly Dominican, and a lot of African Americans. And that made up the audience there. I find it interesting that he loves going into these areas that don't normally vote for him.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we're just seeing a lot of enthusiasm, you know, moving in that direction. I went to a sign waving event recently, and the number of, you know, just black, brown, white people that were honking in support was, you know, it was pretty encouraging.
All right. Stephanie, it's going to be interesting. Stephanie's anchor, so thanks so much, with the Libre Institute over in Georgia. All eyes are going to be there. If Trump doesn't get Georgia, it's hard to imagine him winning. Thanks, Stephanie.
All right. Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
You got it. Meanwhile, the president also responded to to what's going on at the border and going on and how it relates to the vote and, of course, Hispanic. Cut to.
I built 551 miles of wall, which is far more than I said I was going to build when I campaigned. I had a border where the drugs were at the lowest level, the human traffickers in women. They traffic in women. Everything was at the lowest level. I got kudos from, the Border Patrol gave me, with thousands of people, unanimous.
Yeah. The Border Patrol thoroughly endorsed him. And what Kamala Harris is trying to do is, I prosecuted transnational gangs. If she'd be smart, she should give up on winning any of the immigration issues. No one buys it. They know that she called ICE Nazis. They know that she never went down to the border one time, stayed for 45 minutes. We know that she was the border czar, quickly lost that title because she didn't want to do it. So the White House cooperated with downgrading it. But she should just focus on abortion, could focus on the economy, but she'll never have any credibility when it comes to that. So when we come back, Wall Street Journal's own Fox News contributor himself, Bill McGurn, who actually was a speechwriter for George W. Bush, met with President Trump yesterday. How he feels about what he learned from that meeting. Also, Kamala Harris blows off the Catholic Church. Is that going to hurt her at the polls?
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everybody. Brian Kilmeade Show here. Bill McGurn is standing by. Fox News contributor, member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board, writes his weekly Main Street column. Former speechwriter for George W. Bush, was in the White House then. Bill, welcome back. A lot of times Bill gives me the silent treatment. Yeah.
No. Can you hear me?
No, now I can hear you. Bill, were you in the meeting yesterday with the former president at the Wall Street Journal?
Yes, I was. It was fascinating.
In what way?
Just he conversed on a large range of topics. you know, he made clear that the journal and he don't agree on tariffs, but more broadly on trade. But he made a spirited defense of all his positions, and we had a good meeting. He gave us a lot of time, so we were there for quite a while. I hadn't seen him personally, I think, since 2015 when he ran and came in. So it was kind of a surprise for me to see the differences.
In what way? Like physically?
I thought he's, I mean, people are going to think this is crazy, but I thought he's a little more subdued. He was very gracious. Not that he wasn't gracious last time, but he's very gracious. And he did answer the questions kind of in depth and everything. So I mean, when I was watching him, what I was thinking of, would Kamala Harris ever go to any editorial board and have such a far-ranging conversation about topics, some of which she disagrees with the board on? I don't think she could do it.
Because she wants to have an opportunity economy. We have no idea what that means. I know this phrases, but she doesn't want to go deep into it. So, and we know, too, that he sparred with Bloomberg, too, the other day, and he found out. He said he didn't find out till he got on stage that this guy, the host, was a critic. But I don't really thought he was a critic. He just was probing on his policies. Here's a little of the exchange, cut 14.
If I run this country, if I'm going to be president of this country, I'm going to put a 100, 200, 2,000% tariff. They're not going to sell one car into the United States because we're not going to destroy our country. Because I know you're an anti-tariff guy, but I'm the exact opposite. If I had, there is no other way I could have stopped them other than, what am I going to do, negotiate with Mexico or China? You're not going to get anything from them.
So he just said, I think the one thing that everybody's missing, and he doesn't want to make it overemphasize it, but it's a negotiating tool. Hey, China, 100% tax, you know, on tariffs. Oh, we're going to hit you back. No, 120 then. But people want to do the math on what he's saying about the size of the tariff, where he looks at it as a starting point to reconfigure trade relations with friends and foes.
Yeah, I think we just have a different reading of history because he's kind of advanced President McKinley as the defender of tariffs and how they work. I think the problem with the former president's tariff policy, from my opinion, I know a lot of people agree with him, is that it has no cost for the people inflicting it. If you inflict tariffs across the board, everyone pays a higher price for goods that are coming in. Now, maybe the suppliers absorb some of those prices, but they have to get it back somewhere. So I think the kind of idea that we can do this without cost doesn't work. And then, you know, just another factor that you don't take into account, when you impose tariffs, the retaliatory tariffs are really bad, and a lot of innocent bystanders get hurt. So it's kind of a showdown I wouldn't want to get into.
I understood. So the president's very confident about his economic policy. He just left our couch about a half hour ago, and he can't wait to get it back out there and just finish up with 18 days left. And, you know, he's going to be going through the battleground states, but there's nothing out there that the Al Smith dinner or debate or town hall that will be potentially decisive enough to really change this race. Where do you think it's at?
Well, a month ago, I would have said differently. I do think it's shifted ever so slightly to Donald Trump because in the weeks following Kamala Harris's ascension to the nomination, she was rising, you know, every day some gain and so forth. And she surpassed Biden and she made it a race again. And but I think she kind of hit a ceiling because I don't see the numbers going up. And in the swing states, I think Trump's up by an average by 5%, an average of swing state voters. I don't see her getting across the top. Meanwhile, in the national polls, which I don't think really matter for the election because, you know, if you run up the tally in California and New York, that doesn't help you with the Electoral College. But I think some polls have Donald Trump ahead. So I think the same thing, Brian, you talked about, you know, like after the debate, a lot of people, like I thought in the debate with Kamala Harris, Donald Trump lost it. And he lost it because he allowed Kamala Harris to goad him into talking about crowd size, January 6th, all this stuff. And so I don't think he did well. But I think we've seen since then that doesn't mean Kamala Harris did well.
Right.
She didn't really capitalize on the moment. I don't think her standing went up because I think on the flip side, people are looking at her and saying, you want to be commander in chief. In charge of all our country, but we don't know anything about you, you know. And what we do know, what you said before, you're repudiating now. So it's really kind of mystery. And she just doesn't answer. Again, sitting there yesterday on all these issues, some of which I agree, some of which I disagree with the former president. I thought, well, it was amazing he would even come in here and spend time debating it with people. Sometimes disagree. Again, sometimes disagree, sometimes agree. And I can't imagine the Democratic nominee doing that.
I want to bring you to foreign policy. Sinwar is dead. They lost a number of higher-ups. Hezbollah has been really decimated. Iran goes to meet with Egypt, the foreign minister, first time since 2014. They met with Saudi Arabia last week. Word is they're trying desperately to get some type of safe-facing ceasefire, knowing that a retribution's coming their way from Israel at some point. After killing Sinwar, it didn't take long for Harris and Biden to do what they do best, and that is just try to end it without any big picture in mind. Cut 21.
Hamas is decimated and its leadership is eliminated. This moment gives us an opportunity to finally end the war in Gaza. And it must end such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
So, does he understand the word surrender? They should surrender, give up the hostages. They are going to lose. They just want it over. Bill, you were with Bush during this whole war on terror, Iraq war, the surge, everything. Do they just not get it?
Yeah, I think they don't get it at all. Look, these are not conventional fighters. You know, with the country, you fight and you draw to a standstill. And then maybe you reach an accommodation that you can live with. These are terrorists who attack, who target and then attack grandmothers, babies, kids, and so forth. I don't think they can be dealt with. They have to be destroyed. And I think Netanyahu has been brilliant in this campaign. I mean, he knocked off someone in Iran and someone in Lebanon. It's just incredible, the Israeli reach and determination, and the world is a safer place for it. And frankly, Palestinians are safer for it. They're not going to have someone just willing to hide behind their bodies to run up the count.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, too, does anyone want to talk to Netanyahu? Do you have to leak every conversation of the Washington Post? And the prime minister has done well when he ignored Joe Biden. They told him, don't go into Rafah. Kamala Harris said, I've seen the maps. Don't go into Rafah. They went into Rafah. They went in way too slow because of the political situation. And they find the most sophisticated tunnels you can imagine. And they're coming from Egypt right through the Philadelphia border. And that's where Rafah is. And they killed a ton of terrorists there. And now they're saying they never wanted to hit Hezbollah. They want to just have a negotiation. Instead, they decapitated Hezbollah, but they're not dead yet. Why don't we let Israel win?
Well, I think one of the problems is Joe Biden spent, you know, nearly half a century in the Senate. And I think his approach to world problems is if someone disrupts the peace or the status quo, he wants to work to get it back to the status quo that he knows and was comfortable with. And I think that's a mistaken formula especially regarding terrorists. It reminds me at the beginning of the Cold War, you know, a lot of people saw the Cold War as something to manage. You know, it was at a tense standoff, and a lot of people liked it that way. Remember, a lot of people opposed Reagan, the Star Wars, the stingers to the Afghan support. They opposed that in the ground. It was disrupting the status quo, right? But remember, I think it was Judge Clark, Reagan's best friend. They were talking about the Cold War, and Reagan was talking about this idea that you manage it, and he said, my idea is different. We win, they lose. And I think that's Netanyahu's idea.
I hear you. Bill, lastly, little of Kamala Harris does a skit instead of showing up at the Al Smith dinner. Cut 32.
Just so you know, there will be a fact checker there tonight. Oh, that's great. Who? Jesus. And maybe don't say anything negative about Catholics.
I would never do that, no matter where I was. That would be like criticizing Detroit. In Detroit.
Yeah. So it went on, and it's embarrassing for me. It went over like a lead balloon in that at the New York Hilton. Your thoughts about her missing this?
Yeah, I wasn't there. Look, my thoughts are the Al Smith dinner has become an American institution. It's one of the rare, especially as we're so polarized, it's one of the few venues for a civil, gracious, and spirited, they have good-natured, you know, speeches against each other and so forth, to come together like that for a worthy cause,
yeah.
All the diocese charity that it supports. And I think this is akin to Joe Biden passing up the Super Bowl interview, especially for Kamala Harris, where people feel they don't know her. They see this wooden person vague on positions and so forth. It gives her a chance to be herself, you know, in a good and gracious setting. Cardinal Dolan is a great host. I mean, just who wouldn't go to dinner if Cardinal Dolan?
Oh, my God, goodness. He's a wonderful guy.
It's crazy. And I think that comes in the category worse than a crime, a blunder. And plus, let's face it, she's not doing that well with Catholics, and they're key vote in Pennsylvania and Michigan.
I hear you, Bill. It makes no sense. I heard that Hillary told her not to go because Trump could be brutal, or she didn't want to normalize him, or she is not confident that she could deliver humor. But that's the fun part. You go out there and you try it, and if you're not funny, it's okay, because you're not right. Supposed to be. Just try with the humor and show your be self-deprecating. You know, it just would work, but she didn't show.
Bill McGurn, in person.
Go ahead.
People are very forgiving. Even if you're not really funny, people will applaud and laugh because they recognize it takes something to go up there.
And you said and you wrote that she's having a Catholic problem in Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, look at it this way. Hillary lost the Catholic vote and lost Pennsylvania. Biden won the Catholic vote, I think, by 1 point, according to Pew, nationally we're talking about. And he won Pennsylvania. And now Kamala Harris is down to Hillary levels. You know, I just think it's not so much, you know, Catholics would sit around saying, oh, she didn't come. It just adds to a very anti-Catholic vibe. You know, she grilled that judge about his membership in the Knights of Columbus. She's been on the wrong side of every religious liberty argument. I mean, she's a San Francisco progressive. She can't fake it like Joe Biden, who knows Scranton, grew up there, and has those kind of roots. So it's a very alien kind of personality for Catholic voters.
Bill McGurn, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, we'll squeeze in some calls when we come back. 1-866-408-7669. What do you think, a ceasefire next? How about a surrender? And when it comes to the Al Smith dinner, why did Kamala surrender the floor to her opponent? And lastly, where we're at in the 2024 race, I'll tell you what both candidates are up to. Don't move.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But Catholics, please don't be too insulted by Kamala's absence. If the Democrats... Thank you very much. I appreciate it. If Democrats really wanted to have someone not be with us this evening, they would have just sent Joe Biden. You know, he's having second thoughts. You know that, right? He wants to come back. If she does any worse in the polls, they're going to bring him back again, I think. Chuck, he's going to do it. He's the one that got him out.
Right. And the president looked over at, former president looked over there at Senator Chuck Schumer, sitting right by the podium, and said, yeah, you're the one that kicked her out. We still don't know almost anything in detail about why Biden is not the nominee. Why? Because they don't admit what we all know. Mentally deteriorating, couldn't last four more years, could not put up with the rigors of running, and fell apart at the debate. He still sits there and says, I was down by 3 or 4 points, and he's not wrong. Dirk, you're listening to the Fox News Radio app in Hampton, Virginia. Hey, Dirk.
Hey, good morning, Brian. You were talking with a gentleman earlier about tariffs. And
Bill McGurn.
The only point I'd like, The only point I'd like to make is, you know, we learned, you know, all we're doing is funding the Chinese government. You know, that's you know, are we at war with them? Maybe it's not kinetic, but, you know, what's their plan, and why are we paying their bills? You know?
Hey, Dirk, this is what I think you're right. It's because what they're trying to do is jar the system. If you read the Wall Street Journal column today, who interviewed the former president, he wants to basically get out of the World Trade Organization. He wants to go back to those days when before we had an independent arbitrator deciding who was right and wrong for trade situations. Plus, you let China in it. The whole thing was to hedge against their rise. Now they're part of it and abusing the system. So we're subjected to their rules. Trump hates these rules. He only cares about the country, this country. To the point where our allies get ticked off, but they understand it. He's not looking to get money. He's not getting rich. He wants to bring more money here. And he can't stand the fact that we're not manufacturing. And he's got to jar the system and make it too expensive to make your cheap products with slave labor like in China. He wants manufacturing to come back. And then the corporate rate would drop to the teens.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. We're just about 8 blocks up. I was able to go to the New York Hilton last night, invite to stay in the dais at the Al Smith dinner. They invited me a few years ago, and I'm not going to let go of that seat until they say, Brian, we really got to get somebody more important. Bottom of the hour, maybe the man that's the next Treasury Secretary, if Donald Trump wins, and that's Scott Bessent, the CEO and Chief Investment Officer and founder of Key Square Group, used to work with George Soros, and man, he's out of there quick. Julian Epstein standing by. He's served as Chief Counsel to the House Judiciary Committee and Staff Director to the House Oversight Committee for Democrats for 5 years. And keep in mind, I'm going to be in a couple of days now, Peekskill, New York, 7 o'clock, in between World Series games and football contests. Giants play Monday night. I want to see you. I'm going to be streaming on Fox Nation, 7 o'clock, History, Liberty, and Laughs on stage. I'll be able to talk about all my history books, bring them to life, and recreate history in a fun, entertaining way. We also have special guests lined up. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
This entire room is filled with some of the most powerful people in New York City and Brian Kilmeade. Remember, Brian, I told you. Brian and I started doing stand-up together, so we're friends, hopefully.
79th Al Smith Dinner, 6 blocks from our studio. The most powerful people in America gathered for this charity event, raised $10 million, and it didn't feature both presidential candidates for the first time in 4 decades. Why? Because the vice president didn't think it was worth her time, and she released an absurd video instead. I'll let you hear some of it.
Number two.
Those in the administration, they're calling for Sinwar's death is the opening to the end of the war. That's preposterous, given the facts that are on the ground. There's thousands of Hamas fighters still in Gaza, and Israel can't just walk away from that.
You would think, General Jack Keane, you're 100% right. Hamas's leader, October 7th architect Yahya Sinwar, spends his first full day in hell thanks to the IDF. Why, as usual, Biden and Harris are once again pressuring for a ceasefire. Let's make this clear, guys. Hamas should surrender and release the hostages. That's what happens if you want to win.
Number one.
They'll say, let's go out with this one. They've tried many different things. They tried, he's a dictator. He's going to take over the whole world. He's a this. Every week they try something else. So far it hasn't worked. I guess that's the attack they have for this week. It doesn't seem to be working.
2024, 18 days and counting. Trump has momentum, but no one has won yet this election. His latest comments from his visit to our studios this morning on Fox and Friends. And then what was he accomplished? First off, on the decision not to go, Julian Epstein, you've been around a long time, different candidates, different personalities. Some are fun, some are affable, some are just incredibly competent without that magnetic personality. Why wouldn't the vice president go? And do you think they regret not showing up at the Catholic event last night?
I think they've been playing, well, first of all, good morning, Brian, and it's a pleasure to be with you again. I think they've been playing defense, and I think they are sort of scrambling and panicking now. They see the trend lines that are going against them and for Trump. I think they are not happy with how the interview went two nights ago with Brett, and I think they're just sort of scrambling, and they don't know what to do. They don't want to be in an environment where she gets embarrassed. You can smell it from a mile away. Every time she goes into an unscripted event, even though she could be scripted at Al Smith, which makes it even more puzzling, even every time she goes into a unscripted event, you can feel the campaign just fretting and sort of white knuckling, hoping they're going to get through without some major mistake. So which is why I think her numbers are going down. I think she had a sugar high because of the debate. But her numbers were, she was losing before the debate. She had about a 2-week sugar high after the debate. But now people are asking the question again. One, is she an empty suit? Because she didn't seem to have very good answers to Brett's questions the other night. And the second question is, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And I think people look at what's going on in the economy, energy, cultural issues they care about, like immigration and crime. And the answer to that is no. And that's why I've been arguing that the Democrats needed to have a very strong candidate and needed to move to the political center. And, you know, you and I have been talking about this for a year now.
Right. See, Julian, I think they scripted everything from that debate. I think there's going to be a story that's going to be told after this election, win or lose, about what led to that June debate offer, knowing that Trump had to say yes because he said anytime, anywhere. Did they want Joe Biden on display and want him to fail to make the switch? And if they did, my theory is they wanted a jungle primary where everyone's name went in and they came out with the winner and she would have been one of the people. Instead, she maneuvered skillfully behind the scenes. Biden bitterly endorsed her because he knew the DNC didn't want her. And then everything was set except for that last move. And she deserves credit for consolidating behind the scenes. But this is what Jim Gaffigan, Jim Gaffigan said last night, then I want you to comment about, it makes no sense that she's not there. Cut 30.
This, of course, is a Catholic event honoring Governor Al Smith, who in 1928 was the first Catholic to run on a major party. To put that in perspective, in 1928, Chuck Schumer was a first-term senator. Thanks for sitting here, Chuck. Of course, Joe Biden was our second Catholic president, right? After JFK, President Biden couldn't be here tonight. The DNC made sure of that. Oh, that's... I guess I'm the only one that reads history.
Right, so, and he said this is the biggest layup. So when that was going on, I think that she thought that Hillary Clinton got a raw deal last time and Trump was too tough on her and made her look bad. That's what I heard. That was the rumor behind the scenes last night.
Well, that's the widespread rumor as to why she's not going. She didn't want to sort of be teased and made fun of and wouldn't be good on her feet in a situation like that. But, you know, Brian, you know, this is a Catholic charity, as you know, and probably the most important Catholic charity dinner anywhere. You look at the numbers in Pennsylvania and Michigan. Catholic voters are huge parts of the voter base in both states, and you know. So for her to be sort of blowing that off, you put that combined with the sort of abortion on demand position that a lot of Catholics don't like. You know, abortion anytime up to the up to birth, and a position a lot of Catholics don't like. And you can see her numbers. I mean, we've seen the crosstabs on both Pennsylvania and Michigan. Her numbers with Catholics are not good. They're not nearly as good as Biden's were. So another demographic that Democrats are losing.
So I'm reading this story in Politico in Pennsylvania, and they're running events, and they're not letting people in. It's invitation only. And they're letting press in, for the most part, pool press, and they're going in. But you know how Trump, you line up, you make a reservation, but you line up, you can get in? It creates an interest. A lot of people go and say, I had no idea she was going to be in this theater, no idea she was going to be in this gym, no idea she was going to be here. But they evidently got a group that shows up. So they seem to, in the terms of Politico, hardly an enemy organization, they say that they have a disjointed game in Pennsylvania. Julian, Pennsylvania, on all accounts, is vital for both sides.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's this whole thing about trying to control events and trying to control venues. And, you know, you look at the numbers in Pennsylvania and the numbers, you know, the numbers on almost every demographic are worse for Harris than they are for Biden. So, you know, right now, I think Pennsylvania is Trump's to lose. I think this election is Trump's to lose. But to your question, this is a campaign that is, I think, in panic mode. And I think kind of isn't quite sure what it needs to do to control these events. And I think it's trying to figure it out. But you can't figure it out this late in the campaign. This is something that, you know, if you would had a candidate that they felt more comfortable about in unscripted environments, and if they weren't scared to depart from the intersectional left on policy and move to the political center, I don't think you'd be seeing these kinds of problems.
So a lot of people look at surrogates and say, save the day Bill Clinton, save the day Barack Obama, save the day Mark Cuban. And then others come back and go, well, surrogates aren't really going to help. John Fetterman said, I have a anomaly, and it's Elon Musk, who's actually going to bat for Trump. Listen to the senator from Pennsylvania, cut 10.
You know, in the business, you know, a lot of surrogates really doesn't count for much. But Musk, it's undeniable that he's successful. He's the world's richest man, and he's been involved in a lot of important things like SpaceX or AI and those things. And he has a brand, and that's attractive to a demographic that we need to have to win in Pennsylvania. And it's not even about his checkbook.
He also went on and said, young men like Elon Musk. He also has an electric car. And they say the best one, the most successful one, with their own charging stations. And the Biden administration doesn't like him, it seems, because he went and did the Twitter files, bought X, and no longer made it a pliable area to manipulate the media. Your thoughts about what John Fetterman said?
Well, I agree. I think celebrity endorsements like Taylor Swift and Oprah have almost zero impact on voters. The reason I think Elon Musk is different is because he relates to working class voters, I think, much more so than traditional Hollywood celebrities do. But also because he is in Pennsylvania on a regular basis, and he is trying to engineer the get out the vote plan. And there is nobody smarter sort of on anything than Musk. And so when you're figuring out how to do the get out the vote, particularly as you've got all of the absentee voting and you know, all of the sort of the problems that could occur on both sides, you know, Musk is a pretty good guy to have on your side.
So I want you to hear Sinwar, thankfully, is burning in hell right now. He put the October 7th attacks together. He was intransigent when they talked about releasing hostages. He didn't want to deal with it. So they killed Haniyeh in Iran. They wiped out most of Hezbollah's hierarchy. They've killed thousands of Hamas fighters. They've wiped out all but one brigade. And then they finally kill Sinwar. Here's Kamala Harris, cut 21.
Hamas is decimated, and its leadership is eliminated. This moment gives us an opportunity to finally end the war in Gaza. And it must end such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
I know they want it over, Julian, but what should we keep in mind before we call for a ceasefire?
Well, a lot of people were very offended by Kamala Harris's statement there. The war is over when the terrorists give back the hostages and lay down their arms.
Yep.
And, you know, Robert Gates was the guy who said, Joe Biden got nothing right on foreign policy his entire career. And they're proving themselves, they're proving themselves to be wrong on, they're proving Gates right and themselves to be wrong on these foreign policy questions again. I mean, they have been undermining, Biden-Harris has been undermining Israel after about the first month of the, after the attacks last year. They told Israel not to go into Rafah because it couldn't avoid civilian casualties. They were wrong.
She saw the maps, she said. I saw the maps.
You can't do it. I see the maps. You can't do it without big civilian casualties. How many civilian casualties were there in Rafah? Like 12? They told them not to do preemptive strikes on Hezbollah. They took out the entire Hezbollah leadership, and they have frozen them in their tracks. They're now telling Israel that they can't take strikes on Iran. They can't go after nuclear. They can't go after drone capability. They can't go after oil fields. I think they're wrong on that. This is, the terrorists are on the run. Iran is a paper tiger. A ceasefire that preserves the ability of these Nazi terrorists to stay in power and to be completely armed so that they can commit another October 7th Holocaust, you know, at a later date. That is not a ceasefire. That is a deal. That is a sweetheart deal for the terrorists. That it's just unfathomable to me that Democrats are taking this position, particularly as we have our foot on the throats of the terrorists right now. And I think when she makes statements like that, it's when a lot of Jews are going to leave the party. But not only Jews, a lot of sort of that Nikki Haley centrists who want a strong U.S. foreign policy that believes in going after mercilessly the terrorists that are, that want to destroy the West, and that won't step back when we have our foot on the throat of these, you know, these evil Nazis. And, you know, it's not just Biden, it's Macron as well. It's a lot of what's happening in the West has been sort of undermining Israel. And Netanyahu, for all the criticism, he blew off the criticism.
Gotcha.
He blew off the critiques from Biden and others, and he's went and he's done this, and he's been absolutely right.
And success has given him power, and it's winning over the Israeli people.
100%.
And I hope it wins over the American people. Thanks so much, Julian Epstein. Always insightful. Thank you.
Thanks, Brent.
You got it. We'll take a short time out and come back and take some of your calls about what we discussed and what you might have seen last night. And also, I'll tell you what's going to be on One Nation on Saturday. Don't move.
The fastest growing talk show in America. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I know Kamala's word because she spends a lot of time complaining. I won't agree to another debate. But the truth is, I've debated twice this year, once against Joe Biden and once against David Muir of ABC. That was amazing.
And that was funny. I was sitting there in the dais and I heard that too. That was pretty funny. And you look at David Muir, he's proud of himself. He said, I looked at every single Trump rally, looked at every single speech and realized how many things that he thinks he's not accurate on. So I'm going to correct him in real time. Not one correction on Kamala Harris. Let's go out to Joe on Long Island. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Brian, good morning. That was really fun last night. You look real dapper sitting next to Mr. John Mara there.
How great was that? Sitting next to the giant owner. Sitting next to the New York Giant owner.
Absolutely. You rub elbows with the big boys. But the biggest fundraiser for Catholics in America, the Al Smith Dinner, and Harris not only skips it, but sends a vile video mocking the Catholic faith. She was so classless, disrespectful. With a Catholic school girl, she puts her fingers in her armpits and smells them, making Catholics look like doofuses. The Catholic, and then she, Kamala Harris, she's so tone deaf, disrespectful, and condescending. And Kamala Harris, Brian, is the antithesis of Catholic values. I am one, of course. Protect life from conception to death. There's no greater value, and she is the biggest proponent of abortion factory Planned Parenthood. No bigger proponent advocating for killing babies at 9 months old. She was basically saying, Brian, I don't need the Catholic vote. I don't care. That's rubbing her nose in our faith.
I hear you. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. John, Fox News Radio app in California. John.
Morning, Brian. Hey, I wanted to give you a real-life experience. back in April, my mom's 86 years old, lives in Florida since 1988, didn't have a mortgage, had a modest IRA, Social Security. She finally called up and said, I can't handle it anymore. I need help. So she moved out here, and by chance, that hurricane went right through her county. So thank you, Kamala and Joe, for having my mom with me right now. That's the only thing I can thank them for.
All right. Thanks, John, for the story. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. When we come back, Scott Bessent joins us, CEO, Chief Investment Officer at Key Square Group. Could be the next Treasury Secretary. Don't move.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
If I run this country, if I'm going to be president of this country, I'm going to put a 100, 200, 2,000% tariff. They're not going to sell one car into the United States because we're not going to destroy our country. Because I know you're an anti-tariff guy, but I'm the exact opposite. There is no other way I could have stopped them other than, what am I going to do, negotiate with Mexico or China? You're not going to get anything from that.
That is President of the United States in a Bloomberg interview in a wild town hall. And you know what? It was an adversarial host, but I thought he was reasonable. They just have different views. And I think they view a lot of the proposals President Trump is saying as hard math. Well, I'm going to put 100% tariff here, 50% tariff here. A lot of it's negotiation to different countries to reorganize and radically make a move to bring manufacturing back in a free market way. Scott Bessent is with us now, CEO and Chief Investment Officer, founder of Key Square Group. Was an adjunct professor in economics of economic history at Yale University and used to work with George Soros. Now he's not there anymore. Scott, welcome back.
Good, Brian. Great to be back.
Your thoughts about what the president was explaining in that Bloomberg interview a couple of days ago.
Yeah, Brian, you know, I think it's fantastic. What other candidate could have gone toe-to-toe with the editor-in-chief of Bloomberg in an economic discussion? Maria Bartiromo this week described Donald Trump as economically sophisticated, and that's the exact word. And he went in and went toe-to-toe, expressed his views. And look, it is a very America first, pro-worker, with an eye on the economy. You know, Donald Trump wants to bring back manufacturing jobs. How are you going to do that? It's with the threat of tariffs. Maybe they have to get put on. Maybe they don't. Keep tax rates low. Energy dominance, get energy rates low, and squash this Biden regulation. You know, that's a winning trifecta.
And don't you think overarching, this is a wake-up call, especially after the pandemic, when we looked around and realized we need all these things and we don't make anything at home. And then we look at security with the chips and Taiwan and making most of it. And the CHIPS Act is a move in that direction. But the DEI hamstrung it to begin with, the requirements for companies to do these things. The president wants to make stuff here again.
Yep. Brent, Republicans believe in civil engineering, not social engineering. And every Democratic economic policy has social engineering attached to the civil engineering. And we are going to bring manufacturing back. And you know, when you look at the Chinese, I can't remember the Mandarin phrase, but the phrase is military-civil fusion. So they view every piece of manufacturing, every piece of the economy through a military lens. In that fusion, the word military is always first, always first. And you know, we've got to solve for two problems here: that working class Americans have been eviscerated. We told them, here, your manufacturing jobs are going to go to China, but you are going to get service economy jobs. Then we let in whether it's 10 or 21 million illegal arrivals, and they've driven wages down in the service economy. So you know, we've got to get those people back earning a living wage. And secondly, as you rightly point out, COVID was a beta test for us on national security, on supply chains. You know, optimal supply chains are not always optimal. Optimally profitable are not always secure and robust. And we got to get to secure and robust. And when Donald Trump wins, that is going to be a priority.
So Janet Yellen, the current Treasury Secretary, former Fed chair, is against these tariffs. Listen.
calls for walling America off with high tariffs on friends and competitors alike, or by treating even our closest allies as transactional partners, are deeply misguided. Sweeping, untargeted tariffs would raise prices for American families and make our businesses less competitive.
Your thoughts?
Look, I think that Secretary Yellen has undergone an unfortunate transformation. She has gone from technocrat to apparatchik. She's become highly partisan. Her husband was one of 16 Nobel laureates who signed a letter saying that the spending bills, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the American Rescue Plan would not cause inflation. And then we had the worst inflation in 40 years. So, it's a family affair with them. And history, I'm an economic historian. I'm not an economist. And history is not on Secretary Yellen's side.
So
when Donald Trump put on the tariffs in Trump 1.0, inflation averaged about 2%. She is obfuscating here because a lot of things happen when you put a tariff on. The currency appreciates. There are elasticities, consumer preferences, and a lot of times the offshore company has a choice to take it in their margins if they want to maintain market share. So, the modern Republican Party is in favor of fair trade. Unfettered free trade has become unfair to American workers.
So let's take a look at the Wall Street Journal today. President Trump sat down with the Wall Street Journal for how long?
About an hour and a half.
You were there?
I was in the room.
And they pushing back on his tariff policy. They basically say this. The president wants to go the days before the WTO, the World Trade Organization. He doesn't like having a referee decide who's right and who's wrong when countries have disputes. He's not happy that China's in this organization that Bill Clinton put in. And he wants to start building up our manufacturing base. And he feels he can't do it in the WTO. And the Wall Street Journal pushed back on the president's philosophies.
Again, if you have a system that isn't working, what is wrong with rejiggering the system for American workers? And look, the system not working is creating a global wave against free trade. And I think that you've got to reexamine the system to save free trade and make it back into fair trade. That when a country like China is the most unbalanced economy in the history of the world.
Right.
In the history of the world. And when they subsidize, when they have the poor working conditions with all these trade restrictions, when they suppress their currency,
right.
We are not able to compete with them. And I think that it is time to look at what has gone wrong with the system, fix it, and make it fairer.
Well, that's what the president definitely wants to do. He's laser focused on it. And we'll see what happens. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's mostly a negotiation tool. When you look at inflation, we understand slowing the rate of inflation. That's what's happening now. But how do you bring prices down? Being that the deficit is still growing, we're not about. I haven't seen a balanced budget submitted. It's a minimum $200 to $500 billion. Now it's over $1 trillion. How do you get those numbers down?
So, a couple of ways. One is, you bring back down the regulatory state. So Biden administration has put in a record number of regulations, and these regulations are costly. There are estimates that a new home build, the cost may be up $30,000 under the Biden administration. So, you cut regulation, that brings costs down for American families. You bring down the cost of energy, and, energy goes into everything. That when Kamala Harris said, grocery stores are price gouging, the biggest import for grocery stores is energy, getting the transportation of getting the food there. So, once we get back to a fossil fuel friendly regime like Donald Trump wants to do, through energy dominance, through U.S. production, through not letting, Iran, Venezuela, or Russia sell their oil, then that brings down cost. And then when you look at a lot of these tax proposals, right, that Donald Trump is talking about, the no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime, no tax on tips. You know, 40% of the people who get tip income are working single mothers. So, you know, for that lower income cohort,
right,
that brings prices down for them by increasing real wages.
So I personally think we have to double our defense spending. I know that gets people upset, but I also think, then you would know better, we have to, our weapons manufacturing is too consolidated to too few companies. We have to spread it out again. In the 90s, if they'll be better consolidated, it obviously hasn't worked out for us. Our base is too small. And Scott, if you were working this budget for President Trump, would there be a chance to get that spending up to 5%?
I think we can do it over time. I think the other thing we can do is go to our allies. You know, President Trump is resoundingly in favor of keeping the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. In the history of reserve currencies, a reserve currency is also a security umbrella. Every time the reserve currency of the world was also the most powerful military country. So I think what we can do is say we want to retain our reserve currency right. status. We want to continue to be the most powerful military country in the world. And we want you, especially like these high savings countries, to help finance our military. And stay under our umbrella. And Brian, you're exactly right. We are going through a historic transition from the way war is fought. And we're going to have to look at a lot of the incumbent military companies and then think, you know, what we're seeing in Ukraine is this drone technology that's coming from Iran with Russian technology. And the drones are super cheap. You know, the wars of the future are going to be high tech.
Yeah.
And we've got to do that. And with high tech, you can do a lot more with less.
Absolutely. So I love to see that. Lastly, the Wall Street Journal, a big story yesterday. China's in a prolonged slump, and they thought they were going to be able to work their way out of it. They wanted to keep the levers of the government out of it. But then there's now a massive stimulus put into that economy. Why should we care? Is a weak China economically good news for us?
A weak China, normally when a system isn't working, you would fix the system. I just came from a program at the Asia Society Day talking about how Xi Jinping has molded the economy in his image. China used to be capitalism with communist traits. Now he has gone hard Leninist to keep control. And the problem is China needs to do a gigantic rebalancing. The household sector, the
young people aren't working.
Young people aren't working, but the household sector is penalized to subsidize their manufacturing sector. They don't want to do that rebalancing. So what they're doing is they're adding more debt. They're making it more fragile. They are adding to a losing hand.
Right.
But you know, so tactically you can get stimulus, but they don't want to make any structural reforms. And you know, I'm starting to think maybe they're too far down the road on structural reforms. But the one thing that they are doing that is unacceptable, they are dumping finished goods all over the world. They keep moving up the value-added chain, you know, and at a point, you know, the Europeans, the Koreans are not going to have a business model because the Chinese have so much excess capacity, and that's just untenable.
Yeah, we don't know, but people like to paint China as this behemoth growing. I mean, they're way unbalanced. The people are very unhappy. A lot of the experiments President Xi has put forward have not worked. And getting away from any type of market economy has not helped anybody. There's no Jack Ma on the upswing. If there's a Jack Ma with Alibaba coming up, they'll say, okay, you're getting too big, you're out, or you'll go to jail.
Yeah, look, I got to say, we're getting a little of that from the Democrats on Elon Musk. Elon Musk is an American hero. Look, compare SpaceX to NASA. You know, he is doing much more with less. He's going to go up and rescue the two astronauts. And state of California, it wants to ban his rocket launches. So you know, they're moving in the CCP direction. You know, the U.S. has to continue to be the home for innovation and really not imitate like this Chinese suppression of our innovators.
Right. It would certainly help. Scott, have you talked to the president about, I mean, he doesn't want to, I know he's superstitious, but have you talked to him about being a part of the staff? Could you do this with your company? Because you'd have to kind of put that on ice, right?
Brian, we're at a very important moment. There are no conversations with the president until he wins. I am all in for helping him win on November 5th. And when he does, then you know, if I can help on the inside or the out, I'll do it enthusiastically.
You could do it. So the other thing would be, is this your first campaign that you're witnessing?
I have been an active supporter of the Republican Party for most of my adult life. This is the closest that I've been to inside a campaign. And I tell you, it's very exciting to watch this moment and to watch when Donald Trump wins on November 5th, this will be one of the greatest comebacks in history.
Scott Bessent, thanks so much. Appreciate it. It's going to be exciting because, number one, his one issue outside immigration that grades high on over Kamala Harris is the economy. And you're right there. Scott, thank you. When we come back, we'll take your calls, read your emails. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's a true pleasure to be with you this evening. Amazing pleasure. And these days, it's really a pleasure anywhere in New York without a subpoena for my appearance. Anytime I don't get a subpoena, I'm very happy. They've gone after me, Mr. Mayor. Your peanuts compared to what they've done to me. And you're going to be okay.
That is President Trump last night talking about Mayor Adams and the troubles he's in with the multiple charges and indictments. If more don't come, he's going to stick with it. If more come down, I think they're going to have to get rid of him. And listen, he's better than de Blasio. But then there'll be 80 days with this left-wing public advocate, Jermoni Williams. And then there'll be an election for the next year and a half. And everyone will just jump in. But it'll just be chaos for a city that needs leadership. You guys are writing me. And Simone says this. The email from President Biden sent to 65 million Medicare participants was not found in the White House briefing room option to search all. It's doubtful that anyone at Fox would have received this. I posted the President Biden's email to the captive audience of Medicare participants and went on to say that President Biden is claiming that Donald Trump's going to cut Medicare. Understood. On Kamala Harris, as a Fox fan, I can see every time Kamala Harris opens her mouth, she doesn't answer a direct question. Do you see any similarity in her and Hillary Clinton? And that is from Maura. Elizabeth, you're in Missouri. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to respond to the Gaza policy or foreign policy Epstein was talking about. I am a yoga teacher in Knobnostra, Missouri, near Whiteman Air Force Base. U.S. foreign policy is bankrupting the American people, financial, moral, and spiritual bankruptcy. Billions of dollars in one of the most immoral wars of our lifetime, broadcasted live on our phones.
What immoral war? What war are you talking about?
What's going on in the Middle East right now? What's going on with Gaza? This money, billions of dollars, can go to our schools, can go to health care, caring for our seniors.
So you don't think we should support Israel?
I don't think we should be out there slaughtering children. Tens of thousands of children are missing limbs. There are hundreds of international doctors, humanitarian aid organizations have been talking about this for months, and yet we have the same.
Well, what happens is there's the world, and there's the world you want to live in, and because you're a great person, it sounds like. There are horrible people in this world, and they're looking to kill over 1,400 innocent Israelis. And the only way to neutralize that force is to take them out first. And that's what they're doing.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way, fresh off my appearance at Al Smith Dinner. A lot of people are focused on the president and Jim Gaffigan. I'm focused on myself. John Spencer is going to be with us in the bottom of the hour, chairman of the Urban Warfare Studies of the Modern War Institute at West Point College. John Spencer has been advocating for the IDF. He goes to Gaza. He sees how they're fighting and says they are fighting with extreme discipline, putting civilians first, even though, sadly, there are some casualties. But a lot of them are Hamas fighters pretending to be civilians as corpses. And then we have the results of Sinwar being killed yesterday, being confirmed, taken out in a house by a drone, by a guy that's only been in the IDF in uniform for 9 months. The question is now, go for a complete surrender and release of all the hostages, half of which are sadly dead, and we hope to get 45 out. There's just about 100 not accounted for. We'll discuss that. Shannon Bream standing by. Just real quick on One Nation coming up on Saturday night, amongst my great roster of guests, Kevin McCarthy, Michael Rowe, and Hulk Hogan, and John Spencer will be joining us. First, let's bring in Shannon Bream, anchor of Fox News Sunday, Fox News chief legal law correspondent and best-selling author. Shannon, welcome.
I mean, my goodness, that's quite a lineup on Saturday. I'm going to have to stay up late.
Right.
Not get all my beauty sleep that I need for Sunday, because that's you can't miss the show.
You can't. And you like to have one guy on the show that's willing to rip his shirt off.
I mean, usually that's you.
Right. Not this week.
But because you have Hulk this week, maybe both of you can.
Right. Maybe both of us can. If I have a message. So Shannon, first off, who do you have booked this weekend?
We've got Governor Glenn Youngkin.
Nice.
And Governor Wes Moore. So two surrogates for the campaigns and potential future stars for their parties, too.
No question about it. I get the sense, just by looking at Senator Schumer yesterday, mm-hmm. listening to some of these comments, watching Elise Slotkin mm-hmm. campaigning by herself in Michigan, the bloom is off Kamala Harris's rose.
Well, listen, you are hearing from Democrats how worried they are about these really heated Senate races, not to mention her at the top of the ticket in these swing states. Almost everything is within the margin of error
yeah.
of polling. But when you've got these really critical Senate races, too, they listen, on the Senate side, Democrats have far outraised Republicans when it comes to fundraising. They're running ads like crazy. You and I both know, you visit these states, it is endless. It is, you know, 5 minutes of just political ads every campaign break. I mean, every commercial break. But they know, listen, you don't want the presidency and then not have the Senate. That's rough for getting your agenda done. And there's a lot of pressure.
Right. Mike Rogers closing in. Dave mm-hmm. McCormick closing in. Tim Sheehy, Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania. And Mike Rogers over in Michigan. And then, of course, mm-hmm. you have Bernie Moreno over in Ohio.
Yeah.
And then you
the
have
new polling really good for him.
Yeah. Tim Sheehy over in Montana. So these are all possibility of wins. And I haven't yet to meet an expert who says if Trump wins, he takes them with him. If he doesn't, he won't. Are you hearing that?
Well, it's interesting because there are some split voters. We do see that in a number of these states where people have sort of an independent streak. They vote, you know, D on one thing, R on another. And in a lot of these critical swing states, voters do that. Arizona, we've seen it. Michigan, we've seen it. Pennsylvania, we've seen it. So it'll be interesting to see how that works with these Senate races, too. I mean, does the down ballot help the up ticket? It might in some of these cases.
So yesterday, the Al Smith dinner, big Catholic dinner, raised $10 million.
Saw you there. I flip that thing on. I say to Sheldon, is that Brian Kilmeade up on the dais? Look at that.
And what was his reaction?
He was like, I'm not sure that's him. Hmm. And I was like, oh, no, we're zooming in. And it was you.
Martha McCallum.
Oh,
Maria Bartiromo.
Yes, looking stunning. Not
yes.
that you didn't.
Right.
But, I mean, the ladies really representing, looking fabulous.
Can I tell you what happened?
Please do.
So I find out. I finally have a tux. And I realize it says tails. Nobody has tails, right?
Oh, that's right.
So I realize
well,
I have
billionaires
2 days.
Apparently have tails.
Yeah, evidently. and I'm going white tie. All right, I got to get a white tie. All right. And I should have got it. So I just said, I need a tux. Where can I get it? So I go to Men's Warehouse.
TJ Maxx?
No, Men's Warehouse.
Does Men's Warehouse go the extra step to like the white tail?
Oh, yeah.
Like the tails and white tie tuxedo? Okay, they got it all.
So I go in there and I get measured. And they're supposed to have it on Monday, but it's Columbus Day, so they have it on Tuesday.
Oh,
I make arrangements.
Okay.
I pick it up on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, you know, I'm rushing. I just come back from work. I got to rush back to the house. They go, do you want to try it on? I'm like, no, I don't need to try it on.
Big mistake, right?
So I put on the pants. I put on the pants yesterday in my
Uh-oh.
Office, door closed. And as I do it,
Good.
I realize the most impossible thing happened. I said, because the waist is adjustable, what's the big deal?
Right.
They got the length wrong. So they're up
above
my
like,
ankle.
Were you wearing capri pants?
So, no, I had to make an adjustment.
Uh-oh.
So I went in, and I unhemmed it. And
oh.
then it went way too long.
Oh,
so
no.
then I had to staple it.
You did not staple your pants for the
staple
white tie
pants.
Dinner. Nice. I think you should have told that story from the podium.
No one asked me to speak.
I know, but in their hearts, they might have wanted you
yeah,
to.
That, yeah, if, you know, if someone
Gaffigan
got injured.
Gaffigan called you out?
Yes, he did. Should we hear that?
I think we should if you have it.
All right. Yeah, we do have
it. That's a good line. Okay.
Yeah, this is Jim Gaffigan. Do we have that number, Eric, or do I need to look it up? You got it? Let's listen.
This entire room is filled with some of the most powerful people in New York City and Brian Kilmeade. Remember, Brian, I told you. Brian and I started doing stand-up together, so we're friends. Hopefully.
I mean, that guy was hysterical,
but I am
suing him because that hurt my feelings.
Well, and I should listen. Isn't that how you should react these days? Something hurts your feelings, you should immediately go to court.
That's why I retained
you. How you should handle it.
Yes, that's why I retained you full time.
Listen, don't read our Twitter feeds. You'd be suing people left and right.
Oh, I know. Believe me, there's a lot of hate in this world.
People are very upset right now. That's my takeaway from social media. It's like, I just don't want to go there. It's like that little meme of the baby who walks around the corner and he's like, oh no. And he like turns around and walks back out.
Right.
That's me with social media right now. I'm like, oh, people are not happy.
Right. And you're so nice. And I feel like the world could change you. I worry about the world changing.
I'm trying not to let it. DC's a rough place, you know.
Oh, I know. But you choose
to
live
there.
So I want to talk about Sinwar's death. We love this. I hopefully he's spending his first full day in hell, got to see Nocerella again. And then right away, Joe Biden and his terrible instincts starts talking about, now we should just go to ceasefire. I want all the hostages out, but you have leverage. You demand the hostages come out. You demand a surrender, and that's it. But no, from Germany, President Biden, Jake Sullivan, all asking for a ceasefire. Ari Lightstone, who worked with Ambassador Friedman, with the Trump administration, said this from Israel, cut 24.
Yeah, it's important to note that Sinwar is one of the most despicable human beings to have graced this planet, and his death is a very good thing for humanity. There is no doubt that he wished to inflict suffering both on Israelis as well as on the Palestinians. The key now that he is gone is to finish the war, not to end the war, but to finish the war, because as long as Sinwar's lieutenants still retain arms and weapons, and most importantly, the hostages, it'll just be a recycle back to October of 6th of last year, which absolutely cannot happen.
So he knows it's not done. First, during the Jerusalem Post, talks about how Joe Biden's pressuring already. Netanyahu's got to just put up the Heisman, put up the hand. I'm doing this. Let me finish.
And it feels like that's what he's been doing. It does not seem like this Biden-Harris administration has a whole lot of, you know, sway over him. And he's able to point back now, I think, and say, like, look, this had to be done. We're effectively doing it from the pagers and the walkie-talkies blowing up to targeting these top leaders and finding them in places that they were told not to go or they were cautioned against going. I think that the Israelis are like, we hear you, U.S. We're allies. We take that under advisement, but we're doing our own thing. And it's going to be very interesting to see how hard the Biden administration pushes to get something that they will view as a legacy achievement, some kind of ceasefire. Listen, you got to get the hostages out of there. That's got to be, you know, number one goal for this thing. But listen, when Israel says we have, you know, existential threats on multiple fronts, we're going to keep executing our war and we're going to do what we do.
So here's what the prime minister said yesterday and Jack Keane said yesterday about what Netanyahu's message is. Cut 28.
Prime Minister Netanyahu is not going to agree to a permanent ceasefire here when he's got thousands of fighters still in Gaza to deal with. And he certainly has Hezbollah. And he's dismantling that organization right before our eyes every single day. So the fact that Sinwar's death is going to end the war, the conditions are not there to arrive at that conclusion.
So he just hopes wiser heads will prevail, because in Ukraine, we are still limiting what they can do with the weapons that we're giving them.
And that's an interesting thing. We're sending threatening letters, apparently, to Israel that we're told these are not threatening letters, saying if you don't do XYZ with regard to the humanitarian situation in Gaza, then we may limit some access to your weaponry. You know, then you've got Ukraine where people will argue that things that they asked for months and years ago, they eventually get, you know, better permission on how they're going to use these, you know, weapons and more forcefully to different locations and that kind of thing. But that it's just extending this war because it's too little too late.
Right. So, Shannon, I think you're going to have to have a great show again. Last week you had both vice presidential nominees. Uh-huh. That's the first time I've ever heard of that. If you're looking at pure performance since they've been nominated, it's hard to think that Tim Walz is in the same league as J.D. Vance from just what they've been able to do, from the fire that they take on. I can't believe how well J.D. Vance has done. I think it shocked everybody. Do you feel the same way?
Well, I think what's interesting is to look at their favorables, and the more people get to know you, obviously those are going to settle a little bit. But J.D. Vance has really eaten into the unfavorables and come a long way with his favorables. Well, we see the opposite thing happening with Waltz. Kind of the more that people are getting to know about him, the higher his unfavorables are getting. So, listen, they're both out there on the campaign trail, and there were a lot of predictions about how both of them would do. If you just look at unfavorables versus favorables, Vance is moving in the right direction and Waltz hasn't.
Right. There you go. Shannon Bream, go get him.
Okay, see you Saturday night.
All right, Saturday night at 9 o'clock. Hulk Hogan, Kevin McCarthy, Tyrus, Mike Rowe, John Spencer. That's a show. Don't move.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
You show what matters by your actions, not your words. And my actions are, I'm here, I'm in Pennsylvania, and I'm here for a very important reason. Which, yeah, which is... I can't emphasize enough that Pennsylvania is, I think, the linchpin in this election. And this election, I think, is going to decide the fate of America. And along with the fate of America, the fate of Western civilization.
So let me see. Elon Musk is inventing robots that look human that might be able to function alongside us within 6 months. He's putting chips into brains to allow the paralyzed to walk or memory to be regained. Not saying all the quirks are worked out, but this is how close he is. We know about Starlink, the number one satellite company in the world. And then we know about Tesla, the most successful electric car company in the world. And did I even mention his tunnel group, which tunnels underneath, I guess, big cities to try to alleviate traffic? And we know about SpaceX. He could single-handedly put us into Mars and put us back on the moon. And while he's allowing space travel, it's incredible what one man is doing, but he's firmly in the Trump camp. And we were with Trump today. And I can't remember if it was on or off camera. He is just so thrilled to have Elon Musk with him. He said, this guy's amazing, what he's been able to do and what it's like being around him. Fox News polls are out. Question, who do you trust to do a better job on immigration, Trump versus a Democrat? It is September of 2024, Trump plus 15. In August, it was Trump 10. In July, it was Trump 11. So it's only increasing. Choice for president, if voting right now, it is likely voters, 50-48 Trump, registered voters, 50-48 Trump. Trump never is leading the national polls. I'm not saying it's in the bag. Please don't say I'm saying that. I'm just relaying to you what a Fox poll is saying. Obama, RFK, and Taylor Swift, who's most popular, and put into a jumble. Obama, 55% approval. RFK, 51. Taylor Swift, 49. Elon Musk, 44. This is called the surrogate lottery. Another question, difference in support for deporting illegal immigrants. Right now, 57% of non-whites are for supporting it. 91% of Republicans, rural voters, 75%, urban voters, 63%, men, 72%, Democrats, 42%. 2015, it was dramatically lower. For example, non-white voters, 33%. Now it's 57. Republicans, now it's 91. Then it was 70. Rural voters, it was 55, now it's 75. So you see where that's trending. That's why when Trump brings up sanctuary cities, goodbye, build the wall, absolutely. Deport, we're with you. This is what the polls reflect. It's not favorable polling or ignoring adversaries. And here's another one. Top issue in deciding to vote for president. The economy, 40%. It was in September, it was 39. Immigration, 17%. It was 16. Abortion, 15%. It would say the same in September. It was 15. And then healthcare is 8. Danny, you're listening over in Israel. Danny, what is it like over there? What city are you in?
Jerusalem. Hi, Brian. First of all, thank you very much for your great support to Israel.
Absolutely.
All along. I'm from Jerusalem. I'm a citizen of Jerusalem, the eternal capital of the state of Israel. And I just wanted to opine about what the last lady talked about, not funding the Israel war against Hamas and Hezbollah and all other.
Kamala Harris. Yeah.
So what I want to say, what I want to say, Brian, is that she's not only misleading herself, she's misleading the entire people of America while saying that, because Israel is not fighting right now a war for Israel. Israel is fighting right now a war for the entire free world.
I hear you. I agree with you.
Israel is the first fence of defense of the world. The next fence will be Europe, and the next fence will be the United States of America. So keep in mind that Israel now is fighting for the entire world. That's what I want to say.
Brian. And they're doing great. And they're single-handedly made Iran as vulnerable as they've ever been since 1979. That's why I believe we have to aid in the retribution that Israel's certain to give. And you should go for complete victory and surrender in Gaza and get the hostages back. Guys, the way this ends, you tell Hamas, the way this ends is with your hands up and the hostages by your side. Thanks so much. Appreciate the call. It's just frustrating to see other people who just want a quick answer because of an election coming up. I think it's just terrible. And I'm pretty clear on that. A lot of people don't agree with me. I don't really care. There's good news and bad news. There's good people and bad people in this world. Israel's got to deal. They're surrounded by a lot of bad people. Sadly, the people in charge are keeping down and oppressing a lot of good people, like in Lebanon. Like I imagine in Gaza, never been there. Like I imagine they're in Syria, where Hezbollah has set up camp there, and so is Islamic Jihad. And I even imagine in Iran. Here's Matthew Miller on what's next after Sinwar's death, cut 22.
There have been no negotiations for an end to the war because Sinwar has refused to negotiate. There's been no path to ending this war because Sinwar has refused to talk about releasing the hostages or coming to a ceasefire. We now see an opportunity with him being removed from the battlefield, being removed from the leadership of Hamas, and we want to seize that opportunity.
Let's see. You can seize that opportunity, but you cannot slow down the IDF. Can you please, I know you're a State Department spokesperson, but can you please talk to their defense minister, who might talk to our defense secretary, who I hope will brief you on the reasons to finish it. Nobody wants one innocent person hurt. But we don't want another massacre. And if it ends wrong, that's what's going to happen. The massacre is just postponed. The next one's coming. And there will be no restraint then.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Those in the administration, they're calling for Sinwar's death is the opening to the end of the war. That's preposterous, given the facts that are on the ground. There's thousands of Hamas fighters still in Gaza, not in organized battalions like they were, but nonetheless a force that has to be dealt with. And Israel can't just walk away from that and create some kind of post-government where Hamas is there to challenge that government and challenge an international security forces. People, again, are rushing to premature judgment and not considering what the facts are really on the ground.
Keen and other people, especially in Israel, who know what it takes to be successful. A ceasefire under the wrong conditions would be disastrous. John Spencer knows this, chairman of the Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point and one of the most respected military minds in our country. John, welcome back. What changed with Sinwar's death in your mind?
I think the biggest change it provides Israel and the people of Israel who suffered the worst death of Jews since the Holocaust on October 7th. It gives them a bit of closure, much like it took us 10 years to have that closure with the death of Osama bin Laden. But I agree, it is a potential for a turning point to enter the other phases of this war, which won't end anytime soon. I agree with the general that with Hamas still having the weapons, especially the hostages, I mean, there's so much more to do. A unilateral ceasefire would mean defeat. But it's a huge day for Israel, and the ability to do this and find this rat rummaging through the rubble like they did, and to be killed by ordinary Israeli soldiers trying to do the right thing and clear this area of this cancer, It's a significant moment, a possible turning point to even the people in Gaza. This is the butcher of Gaza. Yahya Sinwar is the person who has sacrificed all the Palestinian in Gaza. He is the cause. So it could be a turning point for the Gazans as well.
Tell me about how they fought. You know, there's 42,000 dead Palestinians, they said. People like the Hamas communications wing keep saying these numbers as if none of them are fighters and if these numbers are to be believed. What do you think the numbers of casualties are?
Yeah, well, I can tell you with great certainty that 42,000 Palestinians have not been killed in Gaza. That number's a lie. It's made up of over 20-plus thousand, so about 21,000-plus Hamas combatants, and nobody should mourn the death of terrorists. I don't. But that number also includes anybody who has died for any reason, natural causes, those who have died at the hand of Hamas. The list has double names. It has people that don't even exist. It is missing personnel, thousands of people who literally just people have posted on social media, I don't know where this person is. It goes on the list. That number is a lie, and I really wish our leadership or the political leaders around the world would stop using it. It's not true, and it's full of lies, and we shouldn't be mourning the death of evil Hamas terrorists.
And so how would you characterize the way the IDF is fighting in there? Describe the terrain. Most people listening to us right now are not veterans and certainly don't have urban warfare experience. You are an expert in this area. You went to Gaza. How have the Israelis conducted this battle?
They've conducted it unlike any military in the history of war. I've been studying urban warfare for over a decade. I was in Khan Yunis in central Gaza. The density of what Hamas has built, that every step you take, there's a tunnel underneath you, that every house, every other house is a cache, a bomb, an enemy waiting to shoot at you. Israel has conducted itself by taking more measures than anybody in the history of war to get the civilians out of harm's way while this combatant of Hamas in this combatant hell, you know, with the rubble and the 10-story tall buildings and all the dangers that they have been preparing for the IDF, who have to take great risk to even enter the area. But the IDF are also following their own moral ethical code of protecting civilians in this while the world is criticizing them. And it's weird when I visit that it's actually the opposite, where I talk to the commanders and the soldiers who are like, no, we're doing everything anybody can ever imagine to get the civilians out of harm's way while Hamas is attacking them underground and trying to find these tunnels. It is almost indescribable what the IDF are doing, but they're conducting themselves in this world of lies about their performance.
So now they're saying, do you remember when Kamala Harris said this, when they talked about an operation in Rafah?
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake. Let me tell you something. I have studied the maps. There's nowhere for those folks to go. And we're looking at about 1.5 million people in Rafah who are there because they were told to go there, most of them. And so we've been very clear that it would be a mistake to move into Rafah with any type of military operation.
So how ridiculous do those series of statements sound right now?
Yeah, I mean, especially after an American citizen was murdered in Rafah with five other hostages, brutally starved almost to death and then shot within Rafah, which is very close where this evil leader was hiding and was killed 2 days ago. It sounds really bad. Israel did move 1 million people safely, quickly, and then conducted operations once it basically said, look, I have to do this. And even cutting off the Rafah is the gate to the end of this war. It was where the flood of stuff was coming out of Egypt into Gaza. It is where the hostages were. It is where this leader was. It sounds pretty bad.
Well, put it this way. If you're the leader of Israel and you're depending on American weapons and you're hearing these ridiculous recommendations and demands and you got to do it anyway, you got to just ignore it. But it delayed action. Hostages might have been saved. Rafah might have been taken down quicker. So now you have a situation where Sinwar's dead. They went in through Rafah. And what did they discover, John? John Spencer, they discovered these huge sophisticated tunnels that were continuing to be used to replenish the Hamas fighters and whatever other Islamic Jihad organization was there.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, this is my problem as a student of this, is that the U.S. administration, the international community, in the pursuit of humanity, have protracted this war rather than letting the Israelis, with extreme care, continue the operation and finish it quickly. That's how you end wars. You don't protract them and then constrain them and tell them and actually tell the enemy where to go. Like when the world said, don't go to Rafah, we were saying all eyes on Rafah. And where would I go if I was the bad guy? I would go to where you're telling my enemy I can't go. It's just protracting this war rather than ending it so we can start a better everything in the Middle East.
Right. So not only did they ignore that, they went into Lebanon and are eradicating and killing killing all the Hezbollah leaders they can find. And they're finding a lot of them. They're going into the tunnels and finding these tunnels went right up to the Israeli border. There was another massive attack about to happen, only from a better fighting force in Hezbollah. Would you conclude the same thing, John?
100%, and actually it infuriates me more because we've been spending millions of our dollars, U.S. taxpayer dollars, into the United Nations, into this organization called UNIFIL. 10,000 plus soldiers there submit to not have any of that on the border with Israel, and giant tunnels full of battalion-level forces with mopeds ready to do an October 7th on northern Israel, and they were going to do it. And Israel, again, when everybody told them not, moved forward and is clearing this massive army that was on its border waiting to massacre all the civilians in northern Israel. So it's infuriating because this was under the watch of the United Nations, UNIFIL mandate, all of this. And it should infuriate the world.
It should. So now we have a situation where to what degree has Hezbollah been decapitated? How much of their fighting force is left? I know they have rockets still. They got drones. They're still using them.
Yeah, this is so Israel, with the pager operation, with the targeted strikes, has completely eliminated the organizational chart of the Hezbollah leadership. But there's still, tens of thousands of fighters. But the goal is different. So I don't want people thinking that Gaza is what needs to be done in southern Lebanon or what it will look like. No, this is about pushing back Hezbollah and their rocket supplies that are on the border. But really, if you don't deal with the Islamic regime in Iran, who funded, trained, equipped all of this terror army of Hezbollah, then it's going to be really hard to continue forward and achieve peace. But they still have, 60,000 plus fighters, everything. But you can have a lot of fighters, but if you don't have the terrain matters, the technologies matters, and yes, the rocket supplies and rocket launchers, Israel has eliminated thousands of them, but they have to get on the ground like they are now and clear these tunnels and these bunkers and these houses with giant rockets inside of them, literally civilian houses built around rockets to conceal them.
And you have the UN base right there, and they had to have known something was going on. What do you make of the fact that Sinwar had UNRWA ID on him? That's a UN organization.
Yeah, it pisses me off, to be frank. I mean, the fact that we're still supporting, like, there are still people saying that UNRWA should exist. Like, UNRWA employees were involved in the October 7th attack. It's part of the radicalization of this entire population. The fact that people still fight for it is crazy. But yeah, the leader of this death cult had an UNRWA teacher ID card. It should send a signal to the war, like, enough is enough. Eliminate this organization and create something like all other refugees of the world have. Have it fall under that refugee organization. Why does it have its own co-opted terror organization?
Right. And so we talked about Hezbollah. We talked about Hamas. Now let's talk about Iran. They are doing diplomatic double time. They're now in Egypt, first time since 2014. A foreign minister's in Egypt. They were in Saudi Arabia last week. They're desperate to try to broker, reportedly, some type of ceasefire with Hezbollah and Hamas. Why would they care so much?
Because they're scared of what's got to happen, which is a response to their two-time attacks against another nation with hundreds of crews, ballistic missiles, and everything. And they're scared of a change in the framework and they're trying to build in the Middle East, which is to take over all the Middle East and impose this caliphate and Sharia law that they envision. But Israel and I would hope others have to respond to their direct attacks, let alone the proxy warfare. They built Hamas. They built Hezbollah, Houthis, Shia-backed groups. They are the head of the snake, and they're scared of what's happening next. They took their shot, although the United States told them twice, don't do it, and they still did. So deterrence has to be reestablished. So they're scrambling within their terror networks and everything to try to prevent them losing more power.
So lastly, John Spencer, what targets should Israel hit if they want to be the most effective and send the best message to Iran?
So in my personal opinion, the Islamic regime's massive catapulting of their nuclear program under the watch of the world, to include the insanity of the failed JCPOA, where the U.S. was giving them billions of dollars to not pursue nuclear weapons. The entire world is in danger if Iran gets a nuclear weapon. So that may be a very high priority possible target. But the point of this is to reestablish deterrence, not start war. It's Iran's behavior threatens the region and the world. Unfortunately, Israel is going to be the one who takes the measure to cause the severe consequences that everybody said there would be and strike them hard so they never think about doing it again. But they can't have a nuclear weapon, period.
And lastly, it looks like Russia is supplying a lot of the weaponry to the Houthi rebels and to the region. What can we do to stop that?
Yeah, so one, we can like the Houthis should never have been. Again, it's more foreign policy insanity. We took them off the terror list. We took the sanctions off of them, hoping that they would pursue humanitarian interests for their people. I mean, that's some of the insanity that we can stop. We can put maximum pressure, strike at their capabilities, and strike at the supplies coming in from Russia. But this is what Russia, of course, wants to do, put us in this situation. But there have to be consequences for this. And there's four forms of national power. It isn't just about hitting people with military power, although we're at that point. But it's about pressure in many forms of power.
All right. John Spencer, thanks so much. We'll talk to you on One Nation this weekend to put in perspective what's going on in the Middle East. Historic time to take out a vulnerable Iran and change the shape of the Middle East. I hope people recognize it. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Brian.
When we come back, I'll take your calls, wrap up this hour, and find out if there's indeed more to know.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
There's a group called White Dudes for Harris. Have you seen this? White Dudes for Harris. Anybody know it? Are some of you here? White Dudes for Harris doesn't sound like it. But I'm not worried about them at all because their wives and their wives' lovers are all voting for me.
That is so funny. Welcome back, everybody. It's time to find out if there's more to know, and there is. That was from Al Smith Dinners last night. Well, some more news to share. Jay Cutler, arrested for DUI and gun possession in Tennessee. The former NFL star used to have a hot wife, Christian Calavari, was arrested for DUI and three other offenses Thursday. Not a good look. 41 years old. Let's see if he can bounce back. Two in five U.S. credit card holders have topped out their spending limit. That, according to the experts, 37% overall. Most borrowers who are overextended blame rising prices and higher cost of living. If you live in paycheck to paycheck, you'll try to do it. And this story is intriguing. Donations for an Arkansas man named Aaron Spencer, 36, poured in online last week after Spencer was arrested for killing 67-year-old Michael Fossler, whom Spencer found with his 14-year-old daughter. So according to Facebook, Spencer, from Spencer's wife, the family had no contact order against Fossler and allegedly stalking their daughter over the summer. Back in July, Fossler was reportedly arrested by another agency for internet stalking of a child. So defense lawyers told Fox they suspect Spencer will see his charges reduced based on the circumstances, but they have $100,000 in donations for his cause. Our GoFundMe page was removed and people are being issued refunds. If you donate, I apologize, but they should raise money for this guy, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, it reminds me of many stories on American Justice. There was a story similar to this where a father laid in wait when his son was kidnapped. The kidnapper was brought through the airport he laid in wait and he took out the guy that kidnapped and molested his son.
Saved on prison costs. Next, 50% surge in preteen sadness. Why excess screen time may be to blame. When have we heard this before? They found an association between screen time and depression, anxiety, inattention, and aggression. Spending time video chatting, texting, watching videos, and playing video games was most linked to depressive symptoms. I mean, do I even have to read this? Don't we hear this every day?
You need it more and more because I'm seeing younger kids either through my sister or with my niece's kid, my niece's friends. They're so young and they're just addicted to the phone. Even if they're not interacting with people, they're just watching videos.
Right.
You got to get out and play and have human contact.
Too many toys can be bad for kids. The scientists studied 36 toddlers from 18 to 30 months of age. They're given 4 toys or 16 toys and were observed during sustained play. The toddlers with 4 toys had greater quality of play. They're interacting with their toys for 1.5 times longer than children with 16 toys. So if you have children, take their toys away. Don't worry about the crying. You heard my study. Don't make me repeat myself because I said so. Thanks so much to John Spencer, Shannon Bream for helping us out. Keep it here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I will see you Sunday on Peekskill, New York at 7 o'clock. BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. History, Liberty, Laughs at the Paramount Theater. Streamed on Fox Nation.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and 4-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.